Would you like more Indefensive Plants each month? Well, you're in luck. Indefensive Plants is now offering bonus mini episodes over at our Patreon page. To find out how you can gain access to this bonus botanical content, head on over to patreon.com/indefensiveplants and consider becoming a patron. And as always, thank you for your continued support of Indefensive Plants. Together, we are helping cure plant blindness around the world, one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of IndefensivePlants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How's everyone doing this week? I am so excited about my guest today, because joining us is Ben Nyberg. He's the GIS and Drone Program Coordinator for the National Tropical Botanical Garden in Hawaii, and Ben has possibly one of the coolest jobs in the world. He's developed a drone program for the Botanical Garden that aims to locate, map, and even potentially collect specimens and seeds of some of the rarest plants in the world. As many of you probably know, Hawaii is one of the extinction capitals of the world. There were so many endemic species, both plant and animal, there that have been lost to human development. But Hawaii is also home to some seriously complex and treacherous topography that can be hiding a lot of botanical secrets, and a lot of species might be tucked away in places where humans, invasive goats, and other ecological issues cannot reach them. And that's where drones come in. Ben's drone program is already making massive strides in conservation and is a real inspiration for the innovation and application of new technologies for plant conservation. So I don't want to keep you from this any longer. This is an amazing conversation and I really think you're going to enjoy it. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Ben Nyberg. I hope you enjoy. All right, Ben Nyberg, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How about we start off by telling everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
So I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon, spent a lot of time outdoors there and got real interested in plants and nature, doing a lot of camping.
Nice.
And I moved out to Colorado, to Boulder, to do some schooling and had a great time there, but just was feeling a little landlocked in the middle of the country and decided to move to Kauai back in 2008. And once I got settled here, you know, it kind of felt like home. And so I stayed, got into the conservation world and started working at NTBG, National Tropical Botanical Garden. And, you know, I'm a GIS person by training.
Oh, nice.
And since I've been working in the gardens, I've really taken up a strong interest in plants, especially the endemic plants of Kauai.
Yeah, I mean, you have exposure to so much unique botany out there. I can't imagine what a workday, an average workday must be like, but it is cool to kind of see someone taking a skill set that isn't necessarily attached to plants. You know, it's not like, you know, it's botanical GIS specifically. Like GIS is a massive mapping tool that can do a lot of different things. So what made you want to take the GIS skills that you've developed and apply those to conservation? How did you make that leap?
Well, conservation is something I've always been interested in. And one thing I loved about GIS is how many different areas it could be applied to. So I actually started working for the Nature Conservancy here on Kauai, doing feral ungulate control and fencing and a lot of different things like that. But it was just sort of by chance that this job at NTBG opened up and I was able to get in here and get started.
That's awesome. So it just kind of one thing led to another. I love those moments in life because we can make all the plans we want, but unless you just take the leap and see what happens, you never know how it's going to end up serving you. And I'm sure you probably didn't imagine you'd be where you're at today when you started kind of training in GIS, right?
Not at all. I mean, it's all an adventure, you know, you never know where it's going to go, but I'm loving it right now.
That's excellent. And so, you know, being a nature person, loving conservation, that's amazing. But you know, working for the Nature Conservancy, especially in Hawaii, you can kind of see where that connection to plants really would be strong. I mean, it is the extinction capital, at least of the United States, in terms of territories. And a big part of that really comes down to the plant life, right? I mean, plants are leading the charge, unfortunately, in the extinction rates out there for a lot of reasons. I mean, you mentioned feral ungulates being one of them. But yeah, I mean, did you expect to be so plant-focused?
Definitely not. You know, I wasn't even thinking plants when I moved to Hawaii. And, you know, I just knew that I loved the environment and the landscape. So it's really cool to sort of focus in on the plants and how they relate to each other and then how they relate to the birds and insects and things that are native here.
Awesome. It sounds like you and I probably were pretty similar in that regard, is that we just loved nature and ecology and saw the big picture. But then to have that realization about plants, like you said, interacting with the rest of the world, that's kind of an alien thought for a lot of people. I mean, myself, it was a mind blow to be like, oh, these are organisms interacting with the world.
Yeah. There's so many connections in nature, and it's just inspiring. The more I learn, the more I want to learn about it.
Yeah, I mean, you're in a great spot and a great position. So congrats, you did it. But okay, so GIS is mapping, but like you said, it's a tool that you can do a lot with. And so right now, you know, GIS is exploding in the marketplace. I mean, just in terms of the amount of skills that are things you can apply it to, as you mentioned. But how did you start, you know, really applying it to plants? Where did that connection start to happen, at least from sort of a professional standpoint? I mean, how were you using it, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at, early days?
Sure. Yeah. So when I started at the gardens, we were mostly just mapping the plants within the garden, right? So mm-hmm. I had high-grade GPS units, and every plant that's planted, we map it and tag it and track the provenance information for each of those plants. So when I first started out, that's what we were doing, and it was a good chance to learn all the plants within the garden, you know, see them and understand what each one was. And then as I was working here longer, we started coming up with predictive models and doing GIS modeling for habitats and trying to guess where rare plants would be. We also keep track of all the field data for our collectors. So each plant location in the wild and the forests are tracked and mapped. I got into mobile app development and coming up with sort of new ways for people to keep their field books in digital format and have it linked with our databases and getting all that information streamlined together. And then drones came along, you know, and I was making aerial imagery sets of the gardens and making really nice finished maps. And it just kind of clicked for me that maybe I should be using them to look for rare plants in the field.
Oh, fantastic. And I'm really happy to hear that kind of gradual process. And it's cool to think about it, especially for someone listening that doesn't necessarily use GIS or hasn't even heard of it before. You know, the idea that you could just map plants in a garden and then scale that up to mapping plants, say, on a landscape scale, but then also using it for model building, predictive power. I mean, there's so many different tools and possibilities within this software sort of technology that we have. But then going even beyond that, like you said, then drones entered the picture. I mean, when people hear drones, they usually think military, very bad things, violence, or, you know, those weird conspiracy lights over this, you know, don't you dare come into my yard. How dare you that you fly over, you know, we get a lot of bad news for drones, but watching, you know, what you've done with them, it's very evident to me that drones have this amazing power within them to be used for, as conservation tools, especially for plants.
Yeah, it's been a game changer. Certainly, you know, these cliff areas are so dramatic and there's such variety in them, right? We have these really wet cliffs that are thousands of feet, one of the wettest spots on Earth. But then we also have these really dry, salty sea cliffs and everything in between. So it's cool to be able to check out some of these areas with this new tool.
For sure. And that's my favorite thing as someone who's gotten into it from a hobby perspective, is just using it to see a part of the landscape or seeing the landscape in a way that I don't normally get to see. Even if it's just a few feet off the ground, I don't get an aerial view of prairies, and flying over one is an amazing experience. But to be able to kind of extrapolate that, to go from fun to actually using it, is incredible. But I'm curious, you know, to be a GIS person, it's not like you've learned drone flying skills, right? I mean, there's like a learning curve to being able to manage a drone, fly it properly, understand how it works, to even get to the point where you're like, okay, I think I can use this as a tool. So what was that learning curve like? I mean, did you fly drones before you got there, or was this something that you just kind of found along the way?
I started from scratch.
Nice.
I didn't really have any experience with them. I had a side consulting GIS business, And I was using them to just make maps for people's properties and saw the usefulness for mapping the gardens. And so I think using them for that purpose kind of trained me in being comfortable with them and flying them in automated processes. And just, I got really comfortable using them. And then since then, working on cliffs, there's just a whole range of other factors that come in. So there's a lot of learning that's been happening. We've lost a few drones here and there. But yeah, it's not too tricky to get started, but it's hard to get really good and get the full usefulness out of them.
Yeah. And I mean, as the technology advances, drones are getting better and better. I mean, the one I currently am playing with did not break the bank by any means. I am a poor person and I can afford it, but it has, you know, stabilizers. It's got equalization. It's got, you know, it keeps me from hitting things if I come down too fast. It's amazing what it can do to kind of help the process along, but really at the core of it, you're the controller. You are trying to guide this tool, whether it's automated programming or physically doing it by joysticks, to get it into position and find this. And you know, flying over flatland or just a garden where you're not running into a lot of obstacles is one thing, but to kind of get it out into the landscape, that's terrifying. I mean, as someone that's spent the money on it, even if it's a cheap drone, you're like, oh, that's a lot of money I could quickly lose, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, when I was first learning, I would kind of tense up when I was flying around things and just using it more and getting comfortable with how it will behave. Mm-hmm. I've gotten a little more relaxed with my flight controls. But yeah, like you said, the technology is just so amazing, right? You can put the drone up in the air and take your hands off the controls and it'll just stay right where you want it to be, locked on a GPS and hovering right at the same elevation. And giving all those readings has been super helpful to have spatial awareness when I'm flying in cliffs. Those infrared and sonic sensors tell me how far I am from the surface. So I'm able to collect consistent imagery and also just not run into things and crash my drone.
Yeah. So you mentioned you have lost ones. I mean, how many have you gone through, or is it too many at this point?
Only two.
Oh, wow.
And I was flying one of them in an automated system. Mm. And the terrain here is just so dramatic and varied that the automated system just couldn't quite pick up everything that was going on with the landscape. And the other one, I think, was a malfunction. So we lost that drone, but we were still able to get the images off of it, which were really exciting images of some new plant discoveries. So,
well, that's fantastic. And at least, you know, there's ways to avoid too much direct causal. I didn't personally do it. It was technology that caused it. I was just flying over a river looking at a cool rare plant here in Illinois called coolwort, and whatever the sensor, it hated the fact that there was moving water under me, and it just started acting real funny. And those are those moments where you tense up, but you just have to remember, like, okay, you can lose this if you just kind of get too scared. Just like, back up, come on, find solid land at least.
Yeah, I work with botanists that rappel off cliffs and stuff, and I'd way rather lose a drone than somebody, so...
That's a healthy perspective. So, yeah, I mean, again, this idea of then taking this technology and going just beyond the mapping part of it, but using it for scouting and surveys, and that lends so well to the kind of topography you're dealing with out in Hawaii, no matter which island you're on. But, you know, when did you really start kind of approaching the botanical garden? I mean, was this something they were like, hey, do you want to do this? Or were you like, hey, I have these, I've been using them to do X, Y, and Z. I see an opportunity to use this. I mean, how do you develop a drone program?
I just brought in my own personal equipment and started flying and taking videos and getting some image sets of the gardens and showing them to people. And pretty quickly, they saw the functionality, right? But then we started trying to find funding and got our first DJI Mavic. And that's when we really started looking for plants on the cliffs. And within five flights or so, we had found a few extremely rare plants. Whoa. And people got excited. And that sort of got the momentum behind the drone program going. And then we were able to write grants and have some evidence that it worked.
That's awesome. And yeah, I mean, the proof is in the pudding, is just being able to translate that directly to surveys, people that know what they're looking at and going like, hey, by the way, look what I just found. And that's what's really cool is my first drone was super cheap and it was great for like bigger landscape pictures, you know, taking it out over a forest in fall, beautiful colors, not a lot of resolution. But now I'm finding that the even the littlest uptick in cost, you know, again, not breaking the bank, you can have hyper detailed, high resolution imagery, which is really at the core of why drones are useful. It's that imaging. And so when you're using them for surveys, is that really at the core of it, is just having good photography equipment and then being able to, again, the drones get you the access, but that's the pictures that are what's most valuable for you, the work that you're doing with it, right?
Yeah, I think of it as a flying camera with high-grade GPS. You know, the thing that a lot of people don't think about is each of these photos is geotagged.
Wow.
So I know exactly where that plant is in space every time I snap a photo. So yeah, it's mostly still photographs that I'm using. Hmm. A lot of people ask if I'm using video or what the best way to do it is, but I really like the still photo because there's no movement going on. You got this snapshot where everything is crisp and clear.
Yeah.
And you can circle each one of those little plants and catalog them and keep them all organized.
That's incredible. And having seen the shots that you've taken, it's mind-blowing. I mean, just the advancements that we have made in camera technology to be able to attach that to a little helicopter and send it up there. And like you said, this imagery is really important to be able to geotag because, yeah, okay, I know where some rare plants are. I could take people to go hiking to them. But when it's a cliff face where there's no trail and you've got a bunch of different, you know, I'm looking at an aerial map, you have all of these ravines coming off of the ocean going up into these mountains. You know, that geotagging is super important because you take a picture and you go like, oh, crap, I don't remember where that was. But to be able to have a point, an actual GPS point on the Earth to say like, no, it was right here. And that's repeatability. And then, like you said, with your team, you can go and start planning out surveys and everything like that, right?
Yeah. So, you know, first thing is just finding the plants, but then assessing how to get to them has been another big thing that we're trying to figure out and working through that learning curve. You know, selecting tie-in points, judging distances. So sometimes I'll fly right to the plant's level and then up to where they would be repelling from so we can estimate how much rope we need to get to them. And then just looking at the terrain all the way around, like how to hike to the top of the cliffs and where we should get dropped by helicopter and all those type of questions.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, you just said it there, where you should get dropped by helicopter. It's not like there's a trail leading out to these areas. But that's incredible to know that it's not only helping you find plants of interest, but it's also helping every other step of this process, locating it, getting the topography down, finding, even helping a tie-off point, what's the best access, that sort of thing. That's incredible.
Yeah, and we also have been assessing phenology. So knowing when the plant is in flower and when it's seeding, so we're not going down there unnecessarily. And that's been huge too, you know, just selecting the individual plant we want to get to and then sending our team down to get to them.
Yeah, that's, I didn't even think about it in that context. You know, having done seed collection stuff for rare plants before, even an easy to get to plant that you can walk up to, you know, I've done it three or four times before I get the timing right on when that seed is ready. So to be able to go up to it and take that picture, wow. I mean, you're just peeling away all the layers. It's proof is in the pudding, like I said, of just how versatile this technology can really be if it's embraced and utilized properly.
Yeah, it's exciting. You know, I love my job and getting to do this stuff is just so much fun.
Yeah. And so before we start talking about like specific plants and experiences that you've had, I mean, what's a day in the field like? I mean, you obviously go out with some idea of what you're looking for, but you know, are you the person that's looking at the imagery in real time and going like, I think that's it? Or do you have a team of people with you that are helping along the way? You know, obviously you have to focus in this scenario. You can't really break track and be like, hey, guys, by the way, you know, so what's a day in the field like, just in terms of like setting up and going out there and looking for whatever you're interested in?
It actually starts in the computer lab before that, right? Okay. So I pull up all my GIS maps and I look at these kind of hotspots that we've identified and think about what my best angles to fly to those cliffs are and sort of pick a point on the map that I want to try and get to. And then once we go into the field, usually I'll have at least one or two other people with me. I've been working really closely with someone at the state of Hawaii who brings a spotting scope. And we've developed a really nice system between the two of us. So we'll hike out or in some cases get dropped off by helicopter in locations that we want to be in. And the first thing we'll do is just spend 20, 30 minutes with binoculars and a spotting scope, surveying the area and kind of picking the locations that look the best. Because on a GIS map on the computer, you don't get that detail, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we observe everything, including the helicopter flight lines through the area, because there's a lot of tour helicopters running. Just assess the overall situation. And then once I put the drone up in the air, I'll fly to those areas that we've identified. And I try and get in real close, somewhere between 5 to 10 meters of the surface.
Wow.
So I can get the maximum resolution on my photos. He will track my drone with the spotting scope so he can see where I am. And I can just focus right on the, I'm using an iPad, but
okay.
Looking at that little screen in the field is pretty difficult. You know, you have moisture, you know, if it's raining, you're getting raindrops on there, or if it's real sunny, you're getting glare. So it's pretty difficult to identify each plant on demand while we're flying. So what I do normally is just sort of find these really nice areas of forest using indicator species and then move around that area consistently, taking photos with a little bit of overlap, but trying to capture as much of it in still photo as I can. And then I'll fly the drone back. And sometimes we'll review a few of the photos if there's something that I specifically noticed while I was flying, and look at it and see if we need to go back in and take another photo of it. A lot of times I don't even look at the photos until I get back into my computer lab. So I usually bring about 6 batteries. That gets around 2 hours of flight time. Huh. And in that 2 hours of flight time, I can collect around 500 images.
Dang.
So it's very time intensive, the next steps, but it's the best way that we've found so far.
Yeah, so this is a multi-step process that obviously takes a lot of planning and foresight, but it is interesting to think about doing this, you know, even though you have 6 batteries, that's 6 separate flights out. I mean, what is the average flight time on one charge that you get to be able to go out and, you know, oh boy, if it's 15 minutes to that side of the mountain, you got to really plan that out, right?
Yeah. So our average flight time per battery is around 20 minutes. It's dependent on wind and distance that we're trying to work away. You know, I found that my maximum operating range usually is around 1500 meters. Beyond that, it gets a little glitchy. And I know they quote the drones up to 4 or 5 miles, but legally you can't really do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have my working range and I just try and maximize each battery by hitting things in similar areas.
Yeah. I mean, is there any conditions that you absolutely, obviously raging storms, but is there a cap on what kind of conditions you can actually fly in with the model you're using?
It's mostly moisture, so rain. You know, if we get a really rainy day, we won't even try. One, because you don't want the equipment to get wet, but also if you get raindrops on your lens, your photos are not very effective. And I've spent a lot of time looking at photos with a spot on the lens, and it's annoying to get back into the lab and have that be an issue.
Yeah. That's interesting. At least, the technology's developed so much that these even small, relatively speaking, drones can handle quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with their wind stability. You know, I've flown it up probably in 20 to 30 mile an hour winds, and it'll hang in there. It's not very comfortable. You know, I kind of keep more distance from the cliff, but it's doable.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think I got my first wind warning on mine the other day, and I was over 300 feet in the air, and this drone weighs a little bit more than an average cell phone. It's just, again, you're like, what? How did you do this?
Yeah.
That's so cool. And so, okay, you get pictures, you come back to the lab with them, then I'm guessing the identification process starts. But even a picture that's 5 meters away, you know, it's not a plant in hand, so that's where the high resolution aspects come in. What's that process like?
Yeah, so I'm using Adobe Lightroom, which is a photo management software, and I'll basically dump and rename all my photos into a folder. And then I pull them up in the software and just one by one zoom in and look through the whole photo. They have this people's feature that allows you to kind of tag certain parts of the photo. Mm. So as I see things I'm interested in, I'll draw a little box around each one. And the software will count up those boxes in each photo for you, and you can label them with a species. So that's really helpful. And I kind of do the first pass. You know, we talked about, I'm not a botanist by training.
Yeah.
So I have lots of question marks on these photos. And then I'll bring some of my botanist colleagues down, and we'll sit around squinting at the photos and kind of being like, is that the flower or what are we looking at here? You know, what plant is that? So that's kind of the process. And then once I get through all those, I can export them as geotag photos with the plant name and the number of plants in that photo, and pick it up in a GIS software, and then sort of have it all on a map with, you know, the population numbers.
Well, that's got to be kind of fun, though, too. I mean, obviously, it probably gets tedious depending on how many pictures or if you're not finding stuff. But I mean, just that element of discovery to it, especially if you're looking for something really rare or even feared extinct. I mean, to me, it would be like a little bit of like the lottery, sort of like, I don't know what the next picture is going to give us.
Yeah, for sure. Sometimes the photos, I'll like go out in the field on a Friday and they kind of like, I want to check them out immediately, but sometimes I have to wait until Monday till I can get back into my lab. But yeah, it's exciting. You know, a lot of people probably don't have this type of training, learning botany by drone photo. You know, I'm kind of in this unique position where I've learned a lot of these plants just by looking at them on a computer screen.
Huh. That's a whole new level. Like, I've heard of roadside botany or botanizing from a car, but yeah, botanizing aerially from drone footage. That's cool. And again, thinking about sort of where we're going, especially in the conservation realm as technologies come on board, kind of being at the forefront of that is super exciting, because you're really setting the stage, I think, for a lot of other organizations and conservationists. You're developing a set of tools that can be used, and you're proving that this is a usable system for especially terrain that's extremely hard to get to. So, you know, do you sit back in those moments and go like, wow, we're really kind of at the forefront here of conservation for plants, especially when it comes to hard to reach stuff?
I try not to think about it too much, you know.
Sorry.
No, it's good. I enjoy what I do, and I love collaborating with people, you know, and helping other people get set up and start learning how to do this, because I think it's a game changer in some environments. It's just such a unique way to find plants.
Yeah. And like you said, the environment is sort of the key as to why this is so useful. And so in thinking about it from a conservation perspective, regardless of the plant you're looking at, I mean, there's a reason you're going on to these sheer cliff faces to look for rare plants. Oftentimes, those are sort of the last vestiges of where these small populations are hanging on, right? I mean, the harshest habitats can harbor some of the rarest things.
Yeah, they're kind of protected, you know, they're refugia for rare plants. And I think that's probably true in most places in the world. So, you know, I'm excited to see how this technology continues to grow and be utilized by different people.
Definitely. And so what species have you worked with? I mean, you know, you've made some news recently with one plant, at least in particular, the Hibiscus delphis. Well, that must have been pretty amazing. But you've probably got a few targets under your belt. What are some of the highlights for your experiences so far?
The Hibiscus delphis woodyi was a great one. You know, I worked with Ken Wood, who originally documented this species, and it was so rare, you know, 4 individuals originally. And when those ones died, it was like, is that species extinct? And then to be able to refind it using the drone was super exciting, and definitely got some news. But some of the other plants that I've been working on aren't as rare, but just as exciting. You know, there's this Asteraceae Wilkesia hobbii, which is part of the Silver Sword Alliance.
Ooh.
It's referred to as the Kauai Green Sword. Nice. And it grows on dry cliffs along the Nepali coast. It was thought to have around 600 individuals, but once we started looking for it and developing this system, we found over 6,000 of them. So
wow,
it's just totally changing our understanding of what the species, where it occurs, and what its habitat requirements are.
That's amazing.
Just yesterday, I was out in Kalalau Valley. This plant that we were working on in the Ramnaceae, Guania mayenii. And it was thought to be extirpated from Kauai. There were no known individuals on Kauai. And it was originally only known from Oahu and Kauai.
Whoa.
Oahu is down to two plants left. And there were no known plants on Kauai.
Dang.
So we were doing surveys last August in Kalalau. And I had captured photos of them, but I didn't catch it in my first pass of the imagery.
Huh.
And back in May of this year, I was re-looking through the images and I said, what's that one right there? Like, is that Guania? And we started looking closer and there was a big group of them there.
Oh, wow.
So we all got really excited because it's just incredibly rare plant. And we went back out and assessed how we could get to it. You know, a lot of these plants are in the middle of 1,000-foot cliffs. And it's like, even if we find them, what are we going to do about it?
Right.
These ones were at the base of the cliff where we might be able to get to them. And yesterday we flew in and got right to the base of the cliff and were able to get some cuttings and seeds on them. So that was a really exciting one for plants that I've worked on recently.
Wow, fantastic. I mean, breaking news, right? That's incredible, dude. And that's so exciting to be part of that, especially when you kind of have a grasp of how rare these are. And to think you could have missed it, right? If you hadn't just kind of gone back and looked over that footage, it could have still been a mystery, you know, this potentially long-lost species. And thinking about it from a conservation standpoint, whether you're going from two plants to now a handful or 600 plants to 6,000 plants, I mean, as a member of a botanical garden with colleagues working on different aspects of conservation, that's a huge boost to populations, especially if you can get to them, like you said, get seeds, get cuttings. I mean, that's desperate genetic diversity to increase, you know, the viability of these populations in the long term. You know, even if still the status of these doesn't change, you know, this year, the next year, or the next 10 years, at least, you know, this is a step in the right direction, right?
Yeah, we definitely have a finite amount of time for some of these plants, and trying to get them through this bottleneck and get them into ex situ conservation and be able to just keep them from going extinct. You know, it's not all glory. You know, there's definitely stories of that we're losing plants all the time, and one that we've been looking for a lot recently is Brachiamia insignis, which is in the Campanulaceae. It's a beautiful little plant, but it was only known from the Nepali cliffs.
Mm.
And it's just the populations have been crashing over the years, and it was down to one individual. And we've used the drone to go out and look for it about three times now. And it's unfortunate, you know, and kind of sad, but it reinforces the need for collecting seeds and getting them into our gardens, because we've been able to grow it well in cultivation. And so we have it really well represented here in our gardens and sort of at botanical gardens around the world.
Yeah. And that's interesting to think about, because again, here's a species that very well could be lost. You know, one stochastic event and wild populations are gone, but therein lies the importance of these living collections. You know, botanical gardens are more than just beautiful places to go and hang out and relax or have a wedding or celebrate something. They're vital connections to stopping extinctions. I mean, it is not ideal to have a species extinct in the wild, but if you can have seeds and plants in cultivation, at least it's not gone forever. And this adding this tool set really, I guess, you know, even though you're limited by time and human power and money, this is a step in the right direction. This is yet another way to kind of slow or even prevent extinctions from happening, which that's so cool to be able to have a technology that's both fun and really useful.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, I love it when there's actual conservation work that happens. Like getting seeds and cuttings yesterday was, it's really cool to see it come full circle, right? From finding and identifying the plants and then being able to get to them and hopefully help them survive in the long run.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just again, being part of that process, it's important to also realize that, you know, this isn't just you doing it. It's not just people that are able to grow plants. This takes a team. This takes a lot of different hands getting involved and making this possible, you know, every step of the way. Like you said, this is an iterative process. You have to find the plant. You have to know where it's at. You have to identify it. You have to know when it's going to go to seed, know how to get there. I mean, there's a lot of steps in the way that you couldn't do just by yourself.
Yeah, it's a heroic effort that plant conservationists are going through right now.
Yeah, for sure. And good on them, because again, plants are at the foundation of all of biodiversity, especially terrestrially. But even from just a pure imaging perspective, I mean, some of the images you've shared or I've seen that you've taken, they're breathtaking. I mean, it helps to have that really powerful camera, but the perspectives you get, I mean, it really does give you a sense of like, you see this rare plant on a cliff, you go, oh, that is a dire situation. That's terrifying. Like, I get vertigo just looking at my drone. I can only imagine when you're already up there looking. I'm like, oh. It really puts this all in perspective. It kind of is like hardiness, but also the fragility of it all. And you get to share that with the world. You can post these pictures and show people, like, this is the last few of species. Or just, like, here's the last habitat vestiges that support this plant. Being able to share those images of perspectives people don't really ever get to have, that's also important for conservation.
Oh yeah, that's a huge part of it. Using the drones is such a visual thing, and being able to share those with the general public and inspire people, it's just a great outreach tool. And once I started collecting all this video, I got into video editing and started trying to produce videos and put them all together into a package that the general public could understand and hopefully get on board, you know, and see the importance of plant conservation.
Yeah, for sure. And also, I mean, I don't know if this is common knowledge, but just getting to see plants in their natural habitat, especially if they're rare, that Lysimachia that you essentially took, right, the first pictures of this plant growing in its natural habitat, it was, what was the story there?
All right, so in the center of the island of Kauai is one of the wettest spots on Earth. Just below Mount Waialeale, there's about 3,000-foot cliffs, over 300 inches of rain a year. And there's this Lysimachia that grows on the cliffs there. It's fairly small and long with the flowers right at the end. And no one knew it was there until we got Hurricane Iniki in 1992.
Oh, wow.
Some of my colleagues were walking at the base of the cliff after the hurricane and picked up this piece of the plant. Said, what is this? We've never seen this before. So they described it and it was a new species, Lysimachia iniki.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, it grew up on the cliffs and no one could really get to them because it's 3,000 feet above from the top.
Whoa.
So for many years, botanists would go to the bottom and look for pieces of them that had fallen off and take their binoculars and look up the cliffs and try and estimate what the population was. And there's, you know, a constant mist in that area. It's always sprinkling and you're getting your binocs covered in rain droplets.
Yeah.
So we went in and flew the drone up there. And almost immediately we were seeing them in spots that you couldn't see from the ground.
Uh-oh.
And there were at least 150 of them when the previous estimates had been 50. And we found a new population on a cliff section that had not been seen before.
Huh.
And just seeing them in situ with all the associated species was just spectacular. You know, people were really excited about some of the photos that we were able to pull out in there. It's a difficult area to fly though. the GPS unit doesn't really connect well. So you're basically flying manually around this area with water and wind and everything. It's a dynamic area. For sure.
Yeah. I mean, going back to what you mentioned earlier, the most challenging conditions to fly in and then no help from the technology. But that's so cool because, again, you look at an herbarium specimen and oftentimes in situations like this, they're dried up. They don't really, you get to kind of see what's going on, but they don't really represent what this plant looks like. And it's really hard to put it into context why it looks the way it does, why it has the morphology it does, how it grows. And then to be able to take that out and put that piece together just makes the appreciation and understanding of that species so much better. I mean, those photographs were incredible. It was just jaw-dropping. And to know that, you know, those were essentially the first time that anyone had really had the opportunity to put this plant in context, that's a big pat in the back. So good job for risking that drone and doing it manually just to get those images. That's incredible.
Yeah, thanks. It's exciting.
And so what's on the horizon? I mean, what is going to happen moving forward? I mean, there's more plants out there that need attention. There's more, work to be done. What are kind of the projects you're dreaming up or working on or hoping to get funding for in the near future?
Well, we have a National Geographic grant underway right now for a cutting mechanism that hangs from the drone.
What?
And we'll be able to take cuttings from plants remotely.
Oh, wow.
So there are some researchers in Quebec at the University of Sherbrooke that have been working on this technology. But this grant specifically is aimed to sort of shrink the mechanism and make it suited for Hawaiian cliff-dwelling plants. So that's one project I'm very excited about. It's been a little delayed with the whole COVID thing. They were supposed to be out here in April testing, but it's still happening and something we're extremely excited about. Another project that I have is restoration. We're looking at doing hydro seeding from a drone. So
wow.
We have a preserve on the North Shore of Kauai that have what they call a rain bomb, 50 inches of rain within 24 hours.
Ugh.
Back in the spring of 2018.
That's intense.
We had these landslide events all throughout our valley. Oof. And we were thinking, they're way up on the cliffs. How are we ever going to do anything? It's going to get covered in weeds and those are going to seed out throughout our preserve. So we started dreaming up ideas and thinking about seed balls and different application methods. But we decided to go for this hydro seeding process. So that's underway. And we're hoping that we'll be able to just spray native seeds onto the cliffs and get them to reestablish there.
Oh, that is so cool. And to think about it just from sort of the monetary perspective, there's only so many conservation dollars to go around. And as fun as I'm sure it is, if you don't have the fear of heights that I do to rappel down to these populations, you know, there's only so many people that can do that. And there's only so many dollars to pay them for the risk they're putting themselves in to do that. Not to say that we shouldn't pay people good money to do that. We definitely should. But to think that you could have drones to get cuttings, collect potentially seeds, and then to actually, do restoration over a part of a landscape that humans probably couldn't or safely get to. I mean, again, to think about where this technology can go and to know that you're kind of really at the forefront of it, no pressure, obviously, but that's remarkable, man. I mean, just to think of the creativity and what you could possibly dream up to do with this, it's just, you're blowing my mind.
The technology is there, you know, it's just deciding how we want to use it and what the best way to do it is.
For sure. And so if people listening want to learn more about this, maybe help out or donate, I mean, how can listeners learn more or potentially get involved in some way or another? Obviously, COVID really limits the physical aspect of it, but are there ways people can maybe donate or help out in sort of any of these projects?
Yeah, you can visit ntbg.org. And it gives a broad overview of all our work. We also have a donate page there if people want to contribute to some of this conservation work that's going on. And like I said earlier on, I love collaborating with people and helping people get programs like this established. So you can reach out to me directly at bnyberg@ntbg.org.
Wonderful. And I mean, you mentioned you're doing some video production and stuff, and obviously you take incredible pictures. Do you have any social media accounts that you post this on, or is it all through the Botanical Garden?
I'm just getting started on Twitter. I haven't been really, I've just been lurking, so to speak, following other people and reading what they put on. But I'm going to start making a push to put more footage and stories up on there. And that's at Ben Botanical.
Excellent. Yeah, I'll put up links to all of those. But Ben, thank you so much for talking to us about this. And thank you for the work that you're doing. This is incredible. I mean, I really mean it. Like, it's so exciting to know that, you know, there's some really rare plants out there that are going to have a fighting chance at a future because you've embraced this technology and you had the wherewithal to say, like, hey, I can fly drones. I mean, that's great. So thank you for everything you're doing, and thank you for sharing it with us.
Yeah, thank you too. You know, your podcast is great, and I've some really inspiring interviews on there, and spreading the word about plant conservation. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we're here, right?
Cool. All right, man. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Happy flying. All right, wasn't that inspiring? Such incredible work. I will be posting pictures and links to videos that Ben has been taking over the course of this week. So please make sure you check all of our social media accounts to see what is going on in the world of drone conservation. I thank Ben for taking time out of his schedule to talk with us. And I think I speak for everyone when I say thank you for thinking outside of the box and applying drone technology to conservation. As someone who's just now starting to truly get into drones, this was really cool because I'm already seeing in my own neighborhood the applications of this technology. You can fly up and check out the canopies of trees, look for fruits, and see just a new view of the landscape that humans don't generally get, at least not for the price of a tiny drone. Of course, I will put up all of the relevant links in the show notes for this episode, so go check those out over at indefensiveplants.com/podcast. But before I let you go, I have two shout-outs to the latest producers on this podcast. A big thank you goes out to Southside Plants and Margaret. Both of them went over to patreon.com/indefensiveplants and signed up at the producer credit level. So not only are they getting this resume building title, they're also getting access to all of the kickbacks we have over at Patreon, including multiple mini bonus episodes each and every month. I mean it when I say supporting this podcast through Patreon is one of the best ways that you can ensure that In Defense of Plants has a future. Supporting a podcast financially ensures that it can continue to happen each and every week for free. So thank you again to everyone who's contributed thus far. If becoming a monthly patron isn't your thing, consider picking up some merch over at teespring.com/stores/indefensiveplants or indefensiveplants.com/shop. And if financial support is completely out of the picture for you, which I completely understand, at the very least, give this podcast a review on whatever pod portal you use to download it. Reviews help those podcast metrics recommend In Defense of Plants to a wider audience. And at the end of the day, we want more people listening because we want more people caring about the amazing world of plants. But that's it for this week. I thank you all for listening. Of course, there's so many good things just over the horizon, so hit that subscribe button, follow us, tell your friends, share us, tag us, whatever you have to do, get the word out. But until next week, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.